Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by Ian Dark and John Rawling, two of the voices of boxing. Gents, this week we are talking about venues, and I suppose you've been to the good, the bad and the ugly, and I think I've seen you in most of them. and this is even before we get talking about the hotels. Ian, I mean, we did touch upon it last week and people really enjoyed listening to it. Do you have a favourite venue for boxing?
Probably the Royal Albert Hall or the York Hall. I mean, obviously you think of the Vegas venues, but the most unusual one definitely for me was Japan, the Tokyo Dome, Mike Tyson, Buster Douglas, the famous 42-1 fight, the big upset. The atmosphere there was rather like Lord's on the Friday of a test match. All hell is breaking loose in the ring. But at the end of the round, the Japanese crowd, and it was packed, just clapped like somebody had hit a four in the cricket. It was extraordinary, really. The drama that was going on appeared to be lost on them, but I think it was just how polite and respectful they were. It was very, very different. But, you know, of all the places I've been, that kind of sticks in my memory, that it was such a massive story. And the crowd seemed entirely underwhelmed by it.
John, you got anything that matches that?
I love your call, always have done, of the big ones, I suppose, Madison Square Garden special. But, you know, I was thinking about the ones which are a little bit different. And I am a big fan of the National Stadium in Dublin. You ever been to that one, Tris? Do you remember when Jamie Conlon fought a couple of times there? And the place was absolutely rocking. It's this little purpose-built boxing arena, which was built in about 1938, 39, something like that. And it's still there to this day, sadly, because of some of the political shenanigans associated with Irish boxing. We don't seem to go there anymore. But I did used to love going there. And I always have a bit of a soft spot for Irish venues. The King's Hall was terrific in Belfast. Ulster Hall's a brilliant venue as well. And, you know, add the Odyssey Arena, Waterfront Arena. I've got a real soft spot for Belfast.
What about Mill Street, John? Were you there at that fight?
I was.
The Eubank Collins fight. I mean, that was amazing, wasn't it? That was the night where Collins got us all together on the eve of the fight, I think just after the weigh-in, and came out with all that tosh, really, about how he'd been hypnotized so that he wasn't going to feel any pain. And that seemed to spook Eubank, and we were getting stories, oh, the fight's off. Chris doesn't want to fight. He's heard about this. I mean, it was a psychological blow, but that was an extraordinary venue. We had to drive from Cork out there, about half an hour away. And yeah, you know, a memorable win for Collins, as it turned out. His psychological ploy worked.
It did. I played a little part in that because I had the interview with Collins saying all this stuff, and I played it to Chris Eubank, and it completely freaked him. At one stage, that fight was off. He was saying to Barry Hearn, I'm not prepared to go in the ring against a man who doesn't know when he's hurt, who doesn't, you know, because you've got to remember this is post Michael Watson.
Yeah.
And it completely got to him. Yeah. I mean, the arena was great atmosphere, wasn't it? Huge,
yeah.
Irish occasion, as it turned out. It was owned by a guy called Noel C. Duggan. Remember him? And they staged the Eurovision Song Contest there in 1993 or 95, something like that. 1993, wasn't it? Because the fight was 1995. And I was actually doing a little bit of sneaky work on the internet, looking to see if Noel C. Duggan is still around. He's 90 and still runs the place to this day.
Cracky. That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, that was weird. We stayed in Cork, and I remember somebody saying to us, it just felt a little bit unnerved there, because I said, everything's all right here. You know, I was thinking of the Troubles, which, of course, you know, hadn't ended that long ago. And the guy said to me, yeah, you're going to be all right, he said, but, you know, he said, don't go in that pub on the corner there. Oh, and the other one is the other you will need to avoid is he said, they won't appreciate your English accent. So we kind of thought we might eat in the hotel, you know, after that.
That's great.
We didn't stay in Cork. We stayed at a big old railway hotel called the Great Southern in Killarney. And it turned out that the whole Collins entourage was there. And obviously what happened happened. He wins the title, inflicts a defeat on Eubank. And the party afterwards in that hotel had to be seen to be believed. It went literally right the way through the night, 100% through the night. And I think it's safe to say that that party, just about every conceivable base was touched. It was an extraordinary night, memories of which I will carry with me forevermore.
Yeah. I mean, John, I think you definitely trumped me on the hotel at that for that one, because ours was a dump.
That's great. Hey, if I say Bear Pit, is there a atmosphere or venue that comes to mind in terms of the crowd? I always remember covering the first fight between Carl Froch and Mikael Kessler in Denmark, where it was in Herning. And if you remember, it was the Ash Cloud story where Froch was delayed going over. But I always remember thinking that Kessler was willed to victory by his fans that night. You know, when they talk about the 12th man, that was what it felt like that night. You know, the Danes just came on so strong for Kessler. And I'm not saying that Froch went into a shell at all, because he did not, definitely. But it gave Kessler an extra bit of surge, you know, and you could just see it, you know, going through his veins, the adrenaline and everything else that the crowd brought to him. Have you got an atmosphere that can, that sort of matches that?
I think the most intimidating one I can remember, and we've mentioned it before in this series, was Prince Nassim Hamid against Steve Robinson in Cardiff. That did feel very, very edgy, with the whole crowd chanting Hamid, Hamid, who the F is Hamid. Yeah, I thought it was all going to kick off there that night. There have been a few, of course, the famous riot at Madison Square Garden, Riddick Bowe and Andrew Gallotta, where there were police cars for as far as you could see on 7th Avenue outside. People were throwing chairs, and I was under the ring apron commentating on the scenes. And I suddenly realised, I'm looking at a monitor commentating on it, that a bloke is approaching me with a chair to try and knock over my head. And luckily somebody stood in. So, yeah, been one or two edgy ones along the way. Few fights have broken out. But, you know, I'm always amazed, really. You mentioned that, Tris. I'm always amazed that boxing crowds in the main seem to be pretty well educated, and they know what they're looking at. And that's good occasionally. And sometimes you feel like it's going to kick off when the people who have come to support a particular boxer aren't really boxing fans. They're maybe football fans from that town who have just got behind that particular fighter.
Yeah. Well, I remember a night where it went toxic, and that was when I covered, in fact, I didn't cover it. I went as a fan to Tyson against Gallotta in Detroit. And if you remember, Al Serto was there trying to push Gallotta out, back out into the fray. And he was saying he didn't want to fight on, and the fight was then stopped. When Tyson was going back under the curtain, which was close to where I was sitting, he was being pelted by drinks and all sorts. And I had a very cheap camera at the time. You know, this was before the advent of digital. And I was taking pictures, and one shot just got a load of drink just flying through the air. No picture of Tyson, just a load of drink flying. But I suppose, you know, like you say, sometimes though, they can go a bit toxic, right, John?
Oh, they can. I mean, I'm not old enough to have been there the night Johnny Owen ultimately cost him his life. But a director a very well-known director now, a guy called John Watts. He was there working for the BBC. And he tells me that the crowd there was beyond belief in its unpleasant manner. And as Johnny was being carried out of the arena on a stretcher, there were glasses coming raining down. And it would be nice to think it was beer, but it wasn't. You know, I mean, most of the stuff which was being poured and filled in his direction was piss. You know, and it was just horrific, apparently. But you know, I'm afraid it does sometimes go with the territory. I always remember that fight, another one in 1995, when Nigel Benn fought Gerald McClellan at the London Arena. Talk about intimidating atmospheres! The bear pit atmosphere there was almost frightening. You know, I mean. You remember, of course, that Gerald McClellan went in there as a very big favourite. And most people thought that Ben was going to get hammered. And the crowd were hugely partisan behind Ben and kind of willed him to victory in what turned out to be an unforgettable fight, maybe for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. One that obviously I've forgotten, but of course you think back over your career. One of the very first fights I covered was Marvin Hagler against Alan Minter for the world middleweight title at Wembley. And that had been preceded, of course, by all that horrible stuff about Alan Minter reportedly saying, I'm not going to lose my title to a black man. So there was a kind of racist overtone to it. Hagler came into London and diffused all of that kind of talk. But, you know, that was another occasion. I was working with Desmond Lynam that night when, of course, bottles were being thrown into the ring from on high. It was very, very dangerous indeed. You know, glass, and they had to cover Hagler up to keep him protected. And he always had a resentment for a long time against Britain and said he'd never fight there again after what had happened to him because he felt he was robbed of his great moment, you know, winning the world middleweight title, which had been a fairly long and arduous road for him. But that obviously sticks out. That was ugly and it was a big stain really on British boxing's reputation.
Yeah, and we've obviously all done the rounds in on the Leisure Centre crew, haven't we? We've been to the furthest north I've been, I think, is Peter Lee, which I did a couple of times with Sky shows with Nigel Wright fighting a Josie Olusegun in one of them. And I remember when Sky changed from Saturdays to Friday, it just made the driving absolutely bedlam trying to get anywhere on a Friday afternoon. I think it's taken me double digits to get up to Peter Lee before, from, you know, setting off at 9 a.m. And for some of those cards that start at 4 or 5, I missed the first couple of fights. Unheard of for boxing news. But Ian, good Leisure Centre memories, or was it rough?
It's a bit like that song, you know, that bloke singing, "I've been everywhere, man." Really, I think, you know, I think I must have been to nearly all the leisure centres in England. You know, they weren't all big fights we were covering because we were contracted to do boxing every Saturday night on Sky Sports. And I used to send joke Christmas cards with the itinerary to John, actually, you know, and said, you know, pretty soon we'll be down at the Isle of Sheppey Leisure Centre. That's one we haven't done yet, you know, to cover the Intercontinental, Pentacontinental light welterweight championship. But yeah, I mean, some of them were horrible, soulless places in which to stage boxing, really. And often the cards were not of the highest quality.
I mean, with due respect, it was
the worst one. I think probably the worst one I went to was down in Newport. Have you been there, Ian? I mean, that really was soul-destroying. I forget who fought there now. It may have been Gavin Rees, but there was a very sparse crowd there. A load of druggies on the square outside, which really made it quite an unpleasant sort of place to be on the night. And it was one of those where you just couldn't wait to get out. But, you know, I mean, let's not forget that occasionally, you had some very, very good ones at leisure centres. Glenn McCrory, Jawed Khalik, you know, these are people who were in small halls but had some fantastic atmospheric nights.
Yeah, I mean, Glenn won the title, didn't he? 200 yards from his front door. That was an incredible night covering him, winning that. I don't think anything would have stopped him that night. Patrick Lumumba, wasn't it? he beat, as I recall. And not a lot of people fancied Glenn. He always had that big chip on his shoulder with Colin Hart, because Colin had written a piece tipping Lumumba to win, but he didn't put the headline on it. Poor old Colin. But he got a lot of stick from Glenn because the headline in The Sun on the morning of the fight was "Glenn's a goner." But of course, he proved him wrong.
Well, yeah, I think it's important. It's good you said that, John, about the leisure centres. I mean, we might mock them, and I mean, they did look dastardly when you show up and there's not enough seating, so you still see the empty basketball nets in the background and all the rest of it in the sports halls and stuff. It's not a great look. But I remember the Mountbatten Centre in Portsmouth, Inns neck of the woods, and I saw a classic between Dean Francis and Tony Oakey, which I think was about 2008, which was one of the fights of the year. And in fact, it was a Frank Maloney bill, and the whole bill was stacked top to toe with Henry Castle, Ben Murphy. There were some really, really good fights, probably four or five fights that were that good. They could have been maybe not in terms of on the build as in being main events, but they delivered so much action. They could have been main events in their own right. It was a really, really classic bill. And that was at the Mountbatten in Portsmouth. Ian, close ones for you. You must have covered or been to some shows there, right?
Yeah, I covered Tony Oakey there a couple of times, actually. I got into trouble about Tony Oakey, and he's a Portsmouth boxer, and of course they were very proud of him down there, but he held a very lightly regarded version of the world title, let's put it that way. And I said on air, it is really to the genuine world championship what Barnsley were to the Champions League. Frank Warren didn't like that too much, and he threatened the old legal action against me. Yeah, so it was the WBU version of the title at the time. So anyway, that got smoothed over, but I think I was saying something like the truth.
Yeah, I think you're on the right side of history with that one, I think.
Yeah.
John, I mean, in terms of this, I mean, it's funny because we see, obviously, when by the time you've cleared out and the lights are gone, sometimes you've obviously got walkout bouts and stuff, but then some of these places have curfews and all the rest of it. I mean, it's just behind the scenes, it's not all the glamour, is it? It's not all the glamour of, you know, showing up, covering the main event and all the rest of it. There's sometimes you got to get out of some pretty grotty situations.
I remember one very grotty situation we had to get out of in Bolton back in 2005. Amir Khan's professional debut against a guy called David Bailey, of huge interest. And we got an enormous audience on ITV. It was on ITV1, massive audience. And I think Amir won the fight in a minute and a half or something. It was a bit of a no contest. But then there was a bomb scare. And I tell you what, did we get off air quickly on that occasion? They got the place empty in a matter of, I mean, it was seconds rather than minutes, and we were out of there. You know, I wasn't going to hang around and take any risk on that one. That was another slightly scary moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking as well, you're going back to intimidating atmospheres. Just to digress for a minute, I forgot to mention one, a terrible one we were at, kind of similar to John's story, really, about Johnny Owen. And that was, we covered a guy called Kid Akeem fighting in San Antonio. And this was one of those horrible nights where a boxer is taken out of the ring with a blood clot on the brain. And as he was being carried out, the whole crowd were chanting DOA, DOA. And that was thoroughly sickening. Now, and just occasionally on nights like that, you're wondering, well, what are we doing? What are we doing, you know, covering this? It was truly sickening.
DOA, presumably meaning dead on arrival.
Dead on arrival. Yeah. I mean, gruesome. Yeah, gruesome. Yeah. I mean, horrible.
Ian, so on this, when we go back to Friday night fights on Sky or even Saturday, did you have a travel partner or did you travel on your own in terms of driving around? Did you and Bob travel all together or were you a stranger?
No, you had to make our own way because Bob lived up in the Midlands, you know, and Glenn was from the Northeast and Jim was coming from Scotland. So, no, used to drive there in the afternoon. You'd do your prep in the week or you'd go to the weigh-in if you could. sometimes you'd ring the fighters up and have a chat with them ahead of schedule, or with all the trainer, just get a bit of an inside line or two. But of course, we as you said, Tris, we weren't just covering the top of the bill. By and large, we had to commentate on the whole of the undercard as well, in case the main fight went short and you're left with nearly 2 hours of airtime to fill. So you'd have to fill that up with the undercard fights. Often, all those commentaries you'd done earlier in the evening didn't get on at all. But, you know, it was a problem. And I used to mention it to our chief producer there and say, there is a danger that we're pretty commentated out by the time we get to the main event at 11 o'clock at night. Of course, the adrenaline got you through 9 times out of 10, but it was a little bit of a talking point among us.
Hey, John, did you do David Hay against Mormek in Paris?
I didn't. No, I didn't do that fight, but it was a very good one, wasn't it? And a lot of people suggested that it was Hay's best night.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, obviously, Ian, I know you did the big value fight, didn't you, with the giant?
Yeah.
Did either of you do Hay Klitschko, or did you both do that?
I did Hay Klitschko, and I did Hay Chisora at Upton Park, which was, that knockout punch he found there was absolutely terrific, and it was like the end of the world that day at Upton Park. It absolutely tipped it down. You remember when Tyson fought Lou Savarese? I think it was just as bad when Hay fought Chisora, and then again when he fought Klitschko, it hammered it down there as well. And what should have been a massive event, a lot of people stayed away because the weather was so foul over there.
And the fight was a bit of a non-event as well, wasn't it, John? I mean, it was a very disappointing effort from Hay, wasn't it?
It wasn't his finest hour, was it? You know, bleating about a damaged toe when Vladimir Klitschko's father at the same time was quite literally on his deathbed, you know. And I think a few people quite rightly said, well, he never said a word about that. And there's David moaning about his toe, you know. So it wasn't. I don't think it was Hay's finest hour. But I mean, I'd say that to his face. I'm not being unpleasant behind his back. You know, he's had some tremendous performances and some tremendous nights. But that was a huge anticlimax, particularly after so much of the fairly toxic build-up beforehand.
Yeah,
one of the most unusual nights I had, Tris, was covering Tony Simpson in a place called Worcester, Massachusetts, against Marvin Hagler for the world middleweight title. Now, predictably enough, I think Tony'd had an injury. He probably should have pulled out the fight because he didn't do any sparring in the last couple of weeks. You know, he just did some like gym exercises on a mat. I remember talking to Terry Downs, you know, the old world middleweight champion who went to all the fights in those days. And he said, what's he doing? Couldn't understand it. Why is the fight even on? Doesn't look in check. Anyway, Hagler stops him in 6 rounds, I think it was. and I make a phone call for a cab after the fight. And the guy at the other end of the phone says, have you taken a look outside, buddy? There aren't any cabs running. So outside, it's 2 feet of snow that's fallen during the fight. I was like, we had to kind of walk back through this absolute blizzard, wondering if we were going to make it to the hotel, which was a good mile away. And, you know, we looked like we'd been on some kind of Antarctic mission by the time the night ended. Yeah, I mean, that was incredible. So, you know, there was a storm in the ring for Tony as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, when you talk about traveling to fight, sometimes it's the weather, the good, the bad, or the ugly that really stands out. I remember going to Froch Arthur Abraham in Helsinki, and it was about minus 15, and it was freezing. You get out there and sort of your hair would start to crisp up with ice, and it was. But then, John, I go going back to the Hay fight in Hamburg, I think that might have been the most inclement weather that I've been. I mean, half the people that even had ringside seats were like, sod this, I'm going to go and sit up in the stands.
I mean, we were just about covered by the canopy over the ring. But again, it was not a nice atmosphere. The British fans there didn't didn't conduct themselves particularly well. And I can remember Vitali Klitschko standing in the corner, looking out at the British fans as they threw abuse in the direction of his brother. And I thought to himself, when I looked at him there, I thought, my goodness, I strongly suspect there's not a man here who could live with this guy for 2 minutes, never mind actually deliver what they're promising to do. And, you looked at him and the look on his face, the look of disgust and anger, I think Vitali could probably have taken every man jack of them one after another.
Yeah, and then I suppose on the flip side, you guys must have been obviously the desert in Vegas is one of the hottest places you'll go anyway. But I remember covering a fight outdoors in Los Angeles, and it was quite funny because it was outdoors and there was a canopy over the ring. And of course, it started early afternoon. And by the time the main event came, the sun had moved around. And I remember Ed Robinson, our colleague at Sky, took a picture of me. And where the sun had been coming in from its side, half of me was bright pink. The other half was as white as a ghost. And he sent me this picture. I couldn't believe it. And obviously, all the sun had been coming in from one side. But Ian, I suppose you've been into some lemon baking climates.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one sticks out. Colin Jones, Milton McCrory fight was on because of TV needs in America at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, and as you say, Las Vegas is a desert city. So it was about 115 degrees, I reckon, at ringside. And all of the commentary teams, all the broadcast teams were commentating with a wet towel on the shoulder because the sun was from behind us. So goodness knows what would have happened without that. I mean, the other weather story that sticks in my mind was when Mike Tyson, you know, towards the end of his career, remember he lost to Danny Williams in Louisville, Kentucky. And just before the fight was about to start, somebody put a little card in front of me saying, there's a tornado warning for this area. I thought, what? Keep talking. We may go off air at some point here. So, I mean, obviously it was a gift to a broadcaster to put that out. You know, Mike Tyson's just going to get in the ring and there's a tornado warning. So that's, you know, you use that to your advantage. Happily, the tornado missed Louisville, but it was around.
Wow, that's great stuff. And then, I mean, just on the Tyson thing, actually, Ian, I had meant to, I think we talked about this once before. I once bumped into you coming off a canal boat or a barge in Denmark at the Tyson-Nielsen fight. And I guess you were sightseeing, but you were sightseeing on your own at the time. There was no sign of Bob or anything else. Is that something that you often did when you went to these places? Did you get to look around these places?
Yeah, you're making me sound like some kind of freak here, Tris. But yes, the answer to your question is, yes, I am a bit of a sucker for a boat trip around. You know, if I go to some city and there are canals and that, I quite like to go on the boat. You know, if I go to Cologne, I'll have a little trip on the Rhine, you know, with a couple of beers or something, and just might make a few notes about the fight while I'm doing it. I used to quite like doing that, just getting away from it all. And if I was in a foreign city, I might use their tube lines and all that, try to understand it. That is some quite weird thing of mine. Yeah, it is a bit freaky.
Good. What about John? Did you do that sort of stuff alone, or were you off? Would you grab a Duke or a Richie and say, right, let's go and look and see what's what?
I think I'm a bit more of a people person. I'm not too keen on my own company in these situations. I like to be, you know, be around folk and have a laugh. But just interesting when you talk about Copenhagen, I actually remember being in Copenhagen for that fight, doing it for BBC Radio. And they booked me into a room. And I mean, you kind of get used to having not great accommodation on occasion. And I you know, usually have quite a broad back on that. But I got to my room in Copenhagen and you literally couldn't open the door to the wardrobe because it was so close to the bed. And if you stood in the middle of the ring and stood in the middle of the ring, in the middle of the room with outstretched arms, you could touch the two walls. And I just I remember ringing the office and saying, you know, I am not prepared to stay here. I'm checking out. I'm getting another hotel and I expect it to be covered. So I just sort of had a huge hissy fit and route marched down to the Radisson.
Did you put a PS on the end using your great line, John? We are not backpackers.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're not hitchhikers.
I remember talking about funny shaped rooms. Do you remember there's a place called the Luxor in Las Vegas? I had to stay there once, and it's shaped like a pyramid. Well, that's fine. It looks great from the outside, but don't get a room on about the 15th floor. Because, you know, the slanting roof means that, you know, you have to duck while you're walking around the room. And I got out of bed first night I was staying there, banged my head against the ceiling, forgetting about it. And like you, John, I went down to reception and saying, please move me because I think I'm going to suffer a serious, serious injury in this place.
I remember once being in Atlantic City and they shoved me in a hotel called, I think it was called the Concord. And it must have been a fabulous hotel in about 1925. But by 1995 or 2000 or whenever it was, to say it had had better days was an understatement. And it had a huge sort of center room jacuzzi with a mirror over the top of it. So I thought, oh, this would be rather nice. I'll lie in here and sort of filled it up and then set the motor going, whereupon it turned a dark brown. The water turned dark brown. I didn't stay there very long. I also remember it was arguably the biggest room I've ever been in a hotel on one of these transatlantic trips. To go from the door into the room through to the shower was 65 paces. 65. That is a serious room.
Was it nice or was it grotty?
No, it was an absolute shithole. It was horrible. really, really deeply unpleasant. It was one of those where you're sort of worried that you're going to wake up in the morning covered with bed bug bites or something. It wasn't very good at all in those days.
Oh my God! Well, I remember getting off a bus at Newark once, and I was so tired I couldn't travel anymore. I was thinking this is in my backpacking boxing days. And I remember getting off the bus and thinking, and I saw a row of motels. And I thought, well, I'll just jump into the closest one. And this probably had to be about 2001 or 2002. And I had to cross a big throughway to get over it, completely illegal. And then I dived down an embankment and I wound up into this hotel. And I went into the hotel and they said, oh, you're on your own. I said, yes. And went in there with my backpack and paid whatever it was, you know, $40. Let them, you know, they gave me some sort of bit of paper receipt, chitty with the details. And I go in the room in a motel and turn on the TV and it's porn on every channel. And I hadn't realized, but it was some sort of sex motel. And I was so tired. It was about 2 or 3 in the morning. I thought, I'm not going to turn on the lights properly because God knows what I'm going to find in this place. And it was one of those, as soon as daybreak came, I couldn't get back out and get back to the bus stop fast enough. Yeah.
It wasn't. You believe that story, John?
Well, yeah, just about. I remember once staying in a hotel in Vegas, the old Aladdin, where Elvis Presley got married. And there was a call up to my room at about 3 o'clock in the morning. I thought, oh, God, here we go. What's this? You know, would you like some company, sir, or anything like that? But there was a very familiar Irish voice on the other end of the phone. And it was my dear old friend, Harry Mullen, one of your predecessors as editor of Boxing News, Triz. And he used to, when he went to these events, particularly over in America, he'd always find the grottiest place he possibly could to stay, so that he'd have plenty of money around with expenses and such like to go and fine dine and do whatever else he wanted, which cost loads of money. And but he'd actually overcooked it this time. He said, I'm terrified. I'm terrified. He said, I need to get out of this motel. There's idiots outside. I'm afraid what's going to happen to me. Can I come up? Can I come and stay in your room? And I just said, yeah, of course you can. Of course you can. Get yourself up here. But the poor man, you know, it's one thing having a cheap room that you don't want to be fearing for your safety.
I mean, there are some crazy places, aren't there, in Vegas? Remember New York, New York? If you stayed there on the wrong side of the hotel, there was a Big Dipper going up about 6 feet from the window every couple of minutes. You know, it'd wake you up first thing in the morning and keep you awake till, you know, way into the early hours as well, because people were always taking a ride. And Circus, I stayed there for the Hagler Hearns fight. In fact, ahead of the fight, because we couldn't get him to Caesar's Palace, not with that fight being so big. And there's, you know, you're having your breakfast, and there are trapeze artists, you know, swinging around above your head while you're trying to eat your poached eggs and bacon.
Sounds like a regular Sunday for Rawley.
I should point out, Circus, there was a safety net. So while you're eating your poached egg, you weren't about to get some trapeze artists coming crashing down onto your table.
Yeah, but that, you know, you don't get that, do you, at the sort of hotel in Manchester, put it that way.
Yeah, the first hotel I stayed at in Vegas was the Stardust, and that's been nuked and blown to the ground subsequently.
That's the one which they used for Casino, the Robert De Niro film.
Yeah.
Wayne Newton was in residence at the time down there.
Ones as well. I mean, I remember there was a horrible fire at the old MGM in Vegas, which I think about 80 people died in it. And I was covering a fight the next week, just across the road at Caesar's Palace. And I was in there, and there was a lot of feeling that may have been an arson attack. And so there was big security, and the fire alarm kept going off all kinds of times. And at one point I felt nervous about it and rushed out of my room at 3 o'clock in the morning with only my underpants on. And I ended up at the bottom of the lift in the casino in my underpants. So, you know, that took a little bit of explaining, but, you know, maybe not in Vegas.
I was going to say, John, I'm not sure we believe Ian on that one, do we?
We were talking a little bit earlier about David Hay and his fights over in Germany. Where was it where the where it all kicked off in the press conference afterwards, and it all got pretty ugly? Yeah, that was Munich, and I was David had, unsurprisingly, after the argy bargy at the press conference, he'd gone missing. It actually turned out that he'd gone straight to the airport and was pretty much hiding at the airport until he was able to get the first flight out. I was fast asleep in my hotel room, and suddenly there's thundering on the door at 3 o'clock in the morning, and open up, or whatever the German equivalent of that is, which I did. Whereupon there were about four armed policemen and a policewoman came barging into the room. I thought it was a practical joke at first. I thought maybe the policewoman was in fancy dress or something. Wondered what was going to happen. But the question was, are you hiding David Hay? Is David Hay in here? I can honestly say that that's the only time I've ever had the question, is David Hay in your bedroom?
Was he?
No, he wasn't. He was at the airport. And he hadn't been at any stage either, I'd hasten to add.
And now I'm not sure I believe Rawley now.
this broadcast could get censored, you realise that, don't you?
Left, right and centre. Oh, goodness me. But yeah, it's crazy. I mean, you guys are what, you know, obviously haven't had the limited work I've had in TV. You guys are what they call talent. So when you got, and I don't mean that in an insult, you guys know what I mean.
What's laughably called talent, yeah.
But when I've been on shoots with different people, whether it's a camera crew or whatever, sometimes they're quite funny about where they stay. So have you turned down more rooms than the people that you've worked with, or have your Richies and Jims turned down accommodations that then you've said, oh no, this will be all right, or then you pulled the talent card and then moved hotels?
No, I've never done that at all, actually. I always believe in you've got to muck in and get on with it. So unless not it's something that's really, really grotty.
Not if you could touch both sides of your room with your outstretched hand.
There is that, yeah.
Well, so this is the thing. So I went on a shoot in America with a bunch of lads from BT, and they didn't like the hotel, and they were like, no, we're not going to stay there. And they got us moved and upgraded, I think, and which I didn't complain about. But also, I think, you know, if you read my best-selling book, Road to Nowhere, which you can buy now.
Buy it now.
Then you'll read about some of the grotty places where I have stayed in America. So I think, you know, a regular motel, I'll take 10 times out of 10, but not good enough for some people. But you guys are quite passive in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember Lennox Lewis used to do his training quite often at a place like it was a honeymooners resort called the Land of Love in the Pocono Mountains in America? So we used to have to go over there and do shoots with him, you know, for our countdown programs and interviews ahead of the fight. So, you know, that was quite a weird place to stay because, you know, they'd have mirrors in the ceiling and big red heart shapes on all the doors and that. So they thought everybody that was staying there was on honeymoon, but we were just like a humble TV crew. But it was quite odd.
You and Bob Mee never got it together then.
Is there a best place you've stayed, John? We've talked about some of the grotty ones. Is there an outstanding place? I always remember I stayed at a place called the Gaylord, and it was a hotel for Pacquiao Clotti, and it's a massive chain in America, one of them owned by a group of billionaires, and it was an absolutely fabulous place. And it was I actually did the Boxing News budget in 5 nights, I think, for the month. Which was the only time I've ever done that, because anyone who's involved with Boxing News will tell you that we always do everything on a budget economy. But it's the first time I ever did it. It was the Fight Hotel, and Pacquiao was there and everyone else was in town. So it was a one-stop shop. So I did get a lot of work out of it, but far more extravagant than anything I'd been used to.
I think the best one I can remember staying in was, Ian was there as well, actually, was in South Africa. Well, Christian Eubank had that awful fight against Dan Shomer when he hadn't trained a lick and, you know, somehow managed to boil himself down to get in on the weight and looked absolutely dreadful and fought absolutely dreadfully. But we did stay in some style there in the big casino hotel, and the big new one at the top of the hill was absolutely sensational. And as well, we played some great golf out on the... on the city golf course.
Well, you remember, John? Yeah, that golf course. I mean, the first thing that happened when you went to play was they said, you can't go out on your own. You have to have caddies who know the course, and don't go in the rough because, you know, there's so many poisonous snakes there. So, you know, you just played your ball from the fairway. That was the other thing. The other thing was, I think it's the 13th hole. They're crocodiles by the side of the hole in this pit. You know, they weren't going to come out and get you. But the story was that one of Chris Eubank's team, I don't know who, knocked his ball in there and actually went in and played it from in there.
It was his minder. There are occasions, you know, on a golf course when you have to say, even though I can see that quite clearly is unplayable.
Sun City, wasn't it? Sun City.
Come on.
That was the fight where Chris Eubank rang me afterwards and admitted that he had lost the fight, which is how we'd scored it on Sky.
He was sitting. Do you remember when we were sitting by the pool and one day, and it was blisteringly hot, you know, cloudless sky, really, really hot. And we were just, you know, I'd got a bottle of ice cold mineral water, and I was just sort of doing that while doing a few notes. And Chris was there. I said, this is bear in mind, this is about 3 days before the fight. And I said, Chris, do you want a drink while we're having a chat? You know, are you insane? Are you insane? And he literally was having no liquid at all for about 3 or 4 days before the fight, so that he could make the weight. And it was, you know, just insanity, really.
Wow. And I suppose going back to where we started with Ian, talking about the applause. I do remember this. I remember when some of my early trips for Boxing News that Claude Abrams and George Zeleny would say to me, oh, you know, you'll be surprised by the atmosphere. And I went out to cover Matt Skelton against Ruslan Chagaev in Germany, in Dusseldorf, I think. And then I was at Basel for Wayne Alcock against Arthur Abraham. And you're right, Ian. I mean, I know you were talking about the Tokyo Dome, but there was an applause for good boxing. And it was... Yes. It wasn't quite soulless, but it wasn't far off. You know, there didn't seem to be any real heart or passion attached to it.
Well, it was weird. I mean, if you go into those Klitschko fights, you know, world heavyweight title defenses in Germany, they'd have this kind of VIP area at ringside where, you know, champagne was on tap and all kinds of wonderful little desserts and tidbits to eat. And I was very pleasantly surprised when we covered one of them there, that they gave us one of the, they said, oh yes, you are a broadcaster, please accept one of these passes. And yeah, we were able to just help ourselves to to a glass or two of champagne after we'd finished the job, and rather a nice meal. But that didn't often happen. But you're right, it was a very different kind of atmosphere. It was almost like, I think I described it on air as, imagine the Royal Ascot atmosphere conveyed to boxing. It was something like that.
Yeah, there was sort of applause, and like you said, five course dinner packages and all the rest.
Yeah, they really do know having two or three Felix Sturm fights over there, and those are real sort of, as you say, Triz, I mean, they were society occasions. And you're not talking a few sandwiches, you're talking a huge, great slap-up meal, plus some of the best wines you can imagine afterwards. Not that I'm a great wine drinker, but, you know, I mean, it really was a different side of a fan experience to anything we know over here.
Hey, but talking about that, I mean, different side of experiences, I think it's probably worth a nod here to Frank Warren, who obviously... has stick in different quarters, but his Deborah shows were always good value, weren't they? Sometimes, you know, he would put on an up-and-comer, sometimes a good fight. I remember seeing an early Tony Bellew fight down there. But do you remember, obviously, he's obviously raising money for Deborah, and it's such an amazing cause. And it's obviously a black tie do, and it's well worth a mention, isn't it? Because he's probably raised a fortune through there. And it's a very different vibe for boxing when you go to those black tie boxing dinners as well. A bit like, I mean, I've covered big fights at Monte Carlo as well, and that's a similar sort of thing where it's where, you know, it's more of a social gathering. There's just happens to be fights on at the same time.
Mm.
Strange place, isn't it, Monte Carlo? It is a weird. A weird atmosphere there. And yeah, I mean, when I've been over there, I've not actually done a fight over there, but I've done quite a lot of athletics over there. And it is strange, you know, with the Russian billionaires on their yachts and very elderly gentlemen with impossibly young and glamorous women alongside them. It's a little bit that sort of an atmosphere. And I always think there's something slightly distasteful about Monaco.
Yeah, and it was £18 for a cup of coffee, isn't it? The equivalent.
It can be. It's not far off that.
Yeah.
Not far off. I remember once making the very, very bad mistake of going into... We went into a nightclub. Don't know if it's still there, and it was called Jimmy's, and I should have known from all the Lamborghinis, Aston Martins, Bentleys, and God knows what parked outside, what sort of a place it was. And also been slightly worried when there was no admission fee to go in there. They just sort of... you in, plenty of dipping and scraping. I foolishly went to the bar and said, okay, boys, first one on me, and bought half a dozen little stubby bottles of beer. And it was nearly £300 for six tiny bottles of beer. That taught me to be Mr. Flash, didn't it? Not a good idea.
Well, I used to cover Monaco. I've covered Monaco in the football a couple of times. And, you know, the atmosphere there is whatever the opposite of intimidating is, that's Monaco. And the joke was that most of the crowd on their way to sporting events in Monte Carlo were really just stopping off on their way to the casino.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, you know, I was given a seat that would be normally reserved for you gents when I was there. I covered some early Golovkin fights, and it was when he was being promoted, I think, by Rodney Berman, the South African promoter. And so I was right on the ring apron, and being able to hear Golovkin's shots to the body from the ring apron were things probably that, you know, as long as I have my memory, they'll stay with me forever. Absolutely painful. Going back to the Frotch Kessler one, actually, where I started talking about Herning, Kalle Sauerland gave me the same seat there, and that was probably as brutal as I've seen, being ringside, Frotch and Kessler smashing the living daylights out of each other to the body and head. It sounded like they were teeing off on carcasses of meat, you know, their body punches. So yeah, I mean, guys, it's been weird and wonderful. We've got all sorts of stuff out of that. Anything else that you would like to add about venues? Weird, wonderful, yes. or well, brilliant, marvellous?
I've got a Madison Square Garden story for you.
Go on.
We were broadcasting live outside Madison Square Garden. It was freezing cold, I remember that day. And we were live, and there were a lot of technical problems. And a crowd had developed right alongside us, you know, they watching on the sidewalk, as they call it. While I'm trying to do the piece to camera, there's these New Yorkers kind of standing next to me, you know, and they're in vision on the shot. And I'm talking about, say, well, you know, we're outside the wonderful Madison Square Garden, of course, one of the, you know, the great meccas of boxing, you know, March the 8th, 1971, the fight of the century, you know, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier in here. And as I'm talking, this guy standing alongside me, he's obviously a wizened old boxing fan, is talking quite loudly. He's coming out on my mic. He's going, "Do you hear what the limey said? The limey said it's the fight of the century. I've been at the Garden for better fights than that." And he started listing all these other fights. He's going, "The limey, I don't think the limey's got that right. I don't think it was the fight of the century." This is all going out live on Sky. And I've had to say, well, you know, not everybody agrees that, you know, but certainly that was the label they put on it then. it was extraordinary. So, I mean, we were lucky to get that broadcast, I think, away that day without somebody jumping in front of the camera and swearing or something.
Yeah, we also talked about, when you're live in, you can't get that back. You can't redo that. So I'm guessing you've had that a few times with rowdy people around you, but that's that was the one time where you've not been able to have them contained as such.
Well, one of the rowdy people was John Rawling. No, not really. I told you before, John used to, because we were all good mates, and it was all part of the fun and banter that got us through these trips. John would sometimes stand in the background if I was doing a live piece with Glenn or Jim, and he'd be making all these gestures to us in the background, like he was pulling a lavatory chain, as if to say, you know, that was a terrible piece. He was probably right.
we've talked about some glamour locations. There's one which I remember, which was anything but, which was Liverpool Olympia. You like that one, Ian? It was.
Yeah.
Liverpool Olympia was built about, I don't know, 120 years ago as an indoor circus and variety place. And you actually saw it on television. And it didn't look too bad. They had sort of big boxes either side of the ring. You could imagine the Muppets, what's it, Stadler and Waldorf, going, this is terrible, up there in those boxes. But it was a fairly frightening part of town that Olympia was. And I remember after they'd been going there for a little while, they had security around the TV cameras. And the story I heard, I don't know if it's apocryphal, I don't know, but it wasn't directly involving me. It was Sky, apparently, and I'm told that their broadcast dish the night before the event was stolen. It was taken away. So in theory, Sky wouldn't have been able to get this up to the satellite to get it to your homes. And now this happened, but somebody came along and actually quietly said, You know that dish, if you want it back, you're going to have to pay for it. Whether that's true or not, I'm not too sure. Was it one of yours, Ian?
I don't remember that story, but it doesn't surprise me.
they had pictures on the plaster and on the wood on the side of that arena of the old elephants and
lions, which used to actually live there once upon a time. They used to be underneath underneath the arena in the bowels of this place, in the cellar. And if you actually look carefully around the place, you can see evidence of the old winding mechanism which they used to use to bring the animals up into the arena. Now that would have been an interesting ring walk, wouldn't it?
Shouldn't give them ideas, John.
Hey, Ian, talking about Madison Square Garden, by the way, I will never forget one of the worst fights I've ever covered was John Ruiz against, I want to say it was Frez Oquendo, WBA heavyweight title fight, and it was an absolute mess. It was horrendous. And I remember Bert Sugar, the late Bert Sugar, walking around with his notepad, holding it up for everyone to see. With instead of it saying punch stats on it, he's put clinch stats on it, just because they were just hugging each other for 12 rounds. And it was a tepid affair. And Bert Sugar, I mean, we talk about Colin Hart, the great Colin Hart being the pack leader over here. Well, obviously, Bert was the pack leader for so long over there, too.
Yeah, yeah. He always had a great line, didn't he, ahead of every fight. TV companies used to just queue up to get a little clip with him for their previews, and we did the same. But you know, he was a great performer, really. And
he was clever.
He was good. I mean, it's a good. I had a few drinks with him there. You know, he'd be puffing away on his cigar and with his trilby on. He never took it off.
Yeah, no, great stuff, John. Anything else that you'd like to add in closing?
In closing, let's think about venues. How about the coldest place I've ever been?
I think that
would arguably, well, it was very, very cold in Doncaster that night when there was the world title fight, which was the Doncaster lad, the Yorkshire lad who won the title there. But I was commentating anyway. I was commentating
with Jamie McDonald.
That's right, yeah. I was commentating with Jamie Moore, who I know is a very, very tough guy, to say the least. Anybody who saw his fight against Matthew Macklin would always agree to that one. But he turned up, it was May, and he turned up, lovely evening at 6 o'clock, turned up in a lightweight suit. By 11 o'clock, it was absolutely freezing. I'd got a huge coat on and I was still terrifyingly cold. And Jamie was sitting there in this thin, lightweight suit, looking very dapper, but his face was very definitely a shade of blue. And I also remember when Carl Frampton beat Kiko Martinez on the Titanic waterfront there. Again, it was the beginning of September and early in the evening, lovely balmy evening, you know, the sort of evening where you could have sat outside in a cafe, had a cup of coffee, had a nice cold beer. But then the wind starts to come in off the loch, and by 10 o'clock, it was terrifyingly cold. And I remember we have something when you're commentating, something called a lazy, whereby you cut the microphone, which the public's hearing, or hopefully you do, and it goes through to the truck. And I can remember saying, can somebody please, please, please bring me a coat? It doesn't matter what sort of coat, anything, just bring me something, because I'm in danger of expiring here from hypothermia.
I'll tell you what, talking about cold venues, what about that place where Richie Woodall fought, Telford
Ice Rink,
wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah, the ice was just under your feet. You know, there was the floorboards, then there was the ice. And I was my feet were, you know, I thought I was got frostbite covering one of Richie's fights there. But, my only closing thought is, please don't take me back ever to the Harvey Haddon Leisure Centre in Nottingham.
Oh, great stuff. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's amazing the miles you cover in this job. You know, I've obviously done Macau in China, which was a unique experience. They call that the Cotai Strip there because it's a mini version of Las Vegas just over in Macau. Then obviously the places in Europe and Las Vegas. And then, you know, the next week you're in the Thamesmead Leisure Centre or the Mountbatten Leisure Centre. Like it's a weird and wonderful job, isn't it?
I remember going to a far-flung arena over in Russia. It may have been Yekaterinburg, or it could have been Chelyabinsk when Anthony Yard fought out there.
And I remember we went out for a beer from the hotel, and we'd been advised, of course, don't do this, don't go off the beaten track. And of course, you know, as per usual, we completely ignored that. Wound up in a bar in downtown Chelyabinsk. And we met the most charming people, lovely folks. There was a guy celebrating his 40th birthday, and we couldn't have had a more enjoyable evening. And I remember one lass who was talking to me, she said, spoke very good English. She said, please don't judge Russia by our government. Judge Russia by what you've seen tonight, the people you've met and the fun you've had. Don't, for goodness sake, think that we're all like the people who rule us.
Wow, great stuff. Well, gents, it's been a lot of fun, as I seem to say every week. It's been great. There's a lot of great stuff. And if you're enjoying Ringside Rewind, please go to wherever you listen to this podcast and rate and give us a review. We're doing quite well on iTunes, and I think we're doing quite well in the charts. And I think we're conquering other areas and not just Thailand at the moment as well, which is great. So thank you so much for listening. Ian and John, thank you very much, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.